welcome to Tara Tea. I'm your host, Tara, and today we are finally covering Halloween Kills. I had every intention of having this episode out in the middle of last week, but we had some unexpected events, and so we had to push the review out a bit. So just to get started, Halloween Kills was originally set to release on October 16th, 2020, but with the COVID-19 pandemic, they pushed it out to this year. It released in theaters and on Peacock on October 15th. I will say I saw it the Thursday before, and it was the largest crowd I've seen in a theater pre-COVID. It was so fun to see it in theaters. Like all of my other movie reviews, we're going to go into full spoiler territory. So if you have not seen Halloween Kills, check it out and come back to me. The movie begins with a lot of logos, and the score is even incredible here. This is just the beginning. I absolutely love the music to this movie. It is fantastic. We hear Hawkins attack and the car driving away. We then hear Cameron trying to call Oscar. He tells him that he messed up with Allison. He has to find her. They show a clip of Oscar and his phone lights up. The sound changes here, and it's like we're hearing the voicemail that Cameron is leaving out loud, but that wouldn't be happening. The phone would have stopped ringing. This is not like a home phone answering machine that will play the message out loud for you. We get another clip of Oscar's dead face. Cameron then sees a cop on the ground. He's like shouting, asking if he's okay, and then jumps over the fence to help him. He screams for help, takes off his scarf, and tries to put it on his wound. When he goes to put pressure on the wound, Hawkins wakes up and starts coughing. Cameron talks to him and tells him to stay with him. Hawkins keeps repeating that he needs to die, and Cameron asks who, and Hawkins says he's going to be the one to get him. We flash back to Halloween night in 1978 with a nice throwback to the original score. Hawkins is chasing after Michael, but he turns the corner after looking at Hawkins and disappears. More officers arrive, and they try to figure out where he went. They decide to split up and start naming off streets. As someone from John Carpenter's hometown, hearing these street names was so cool. This is my home. These are the streets that I live on. And it just gave a little extra scary feel to the movie for sure. Hawkins and McCabe walk down the street when McCabe says that he knew Michael as a kid and that he would stare out Judith's bedroom window a lot. They talk about how Haddonfield is the town where nothing happens, and we see a shot of them overlooking the town. Western Kentucky University, which is the college here in Bowling Green, it's where John Carpenter went to school for a little while, they're known as the Hilltoppers because the entire campus is on this huge hill, and there's a part that you go up to near like Cherry Hall, Van Meter, and when you go up there, there's a part where you can look down and see like all this grass and just a huge view of the city, and that is what this shot reminded me of. And so when this scene is happening in theaters and they show that part, like, I literally gasped because I was like, oh, that looks like home. Like, this makes it a little bit more scary because not only are they saying the streets from home, they're saying like nearby towns and things like that, but now it's starting to look like home. So it was really cool. We cut to Lonnie getting picked on by kids in Haddonfield, and the kids in this town are terrible. An officer pulls up asking if they're all okay. They pretend like they're all friends with Ronnie. The officer asks if they've seen anyone in a mask, and one of the girls says it's Halloween, everyone is wearing a mask. He tells them that it's not safe and to go home. They ask him what happened, and he tells them very plain and bluntly that the person they're looking for murdered three teenagers down the street and just drives off, leaving the kids. They all tease Lonnie and tell him not to get murdered. They leave and Lonnie heads home. He gets scared, and we hear this montage of the kids picking on him. Lonnie takes off running when he falls. Suddenly, we see Michael walking up to him. He covers his face in fear and asks him not to kill him and says he's sorry for bullying Tommy. Hawkins and McCabe arrive, and Michael is gone. Lonnie takes off, and McCabe realizes they're in front of the Myers house. They go inside, and McCabe finds a dead dog. They check a closet and end up hearing thumping upstairs. McCabe goes up to realize he's in Judith's bedroom. He goes to the window where Michael used to stand and looks down to see shoe prints on the ground. Michael rushes him and slams his head against the wall while choking him with a piece of rope. Hawkins tells him to drop, and Michael won't. Hawkins shoots but misses and actually hits McCabe. Michael drops him and just walks off while Hawkins tries to shoot him a few times and misses. Throughout the entire movie, you will realize this town needs target practice. Like, if they're gonna handle guns this much and they're gonna try to be all like badass and go after Michael Myers, like a little target practice will help the cause. So Loomis and the police arrive, and McCabe asks Hawkins if they got Michael, and he says they did. He's not trying to really hold the wound or stop it. He's just, like, watching him bleed out. So, I get why he's upset, but at the same time, like, he did nothing to help. We see the officers confirm that it's Michael. Hawkins goes to go outside, and Loomis asks what happened and if Michael has killed again. Just a little fun fact for those of you that don't know. Loomis here is not CGI. That is Tom Jones Jr., the art director, with makeup and prosthetics on. Colin Mahan is voicing Loomis like he did in the clip from 2018. Hawkins doesn't answer him, and we see Michael standing outside the house, frozen in a shot that mirrors Michael being found by his parents as a little boy in the original. This flashback scene is absolute perfection. I love the throwback scores. I love seeing Loomis. Hands down, love the flashback scenes. We get our opening credits, and like I said earlier, the new score and everything is fantastic. This new theme is absolutely killer. I am obsessed with this opening sequence. It shows this like very happy pumpkin that catches on fire as the orchestral singing starts. And the pumpkins also start bleeding, and we move forward to other pumpkins all going through the same thing. It's like a fitting metaphor for the town of Haddonfield. And apparently there are 12 pumpkins to symbolize each movie in the franchise thus far. We cut to Mick's bar, and we're back in 2018. This is before anyone knows what is going on. So it's all happy-go-lucky, everyone's smiling and having a few drinks and just having a good time. There's a talent show going on tonight, and we zoom to Vanessa and Marcus. They're talking about work and Marcus needing to stand up for himself. Suddenly, we hear a few familiar voices. Tommy talks about the two homicides at the gas station, but wouldn't it be three? You have the two podcasters plus the mechanic? I don't know. Lonnie says they don't even know if he was on the bus. Marion tells Tommy that he's too paranoid. They're all just so happy and having fun and having a few drinks. Like, it sucks to know what's coming. Vanessa and Marcus are bothered by how loud they're being, and they are literally right behind them. And Marcus says something to them so they quieten down. Marcus goes to get a drink. The bartender tells him not to be bothered by any of them. He says they're friends with that crazy lady that almost got killed by Michael Myers. Marcus says that he heard about that and calls her Laura Stroops. He tells them that they survived Michael and come here every year. Lonnie introduces Tommy to the stage. Lonnie and Tommy are not portrayed by their original actors. I adore Lonnie. I am just going to state that now. He is probably one of my favorite parts of the OGs coming back, even though it's technically not the same guy. Tommy, not so much. Tommy gives a speech about the Haddonfield boogeyman, and it's basically for anyone that hadn't watched the original or doesn't remember it, and we get a reintroduction of the survivors because we really hadn't seen them until that speech. Plus, it's been 40 years, so some of the patrons of the bar probably weren't even alive then. Tommy says that Lindsay's babysitter Annie was murdered that night, and they show clips of Annie, including the one where Brackett identifies her body. Now that clip is from Halloween 2, which this timeline is erasing from canon. We see clips of Marion being attacked in the original. They did edit out the shot of the wrench that is being palmed by Michael. That's how they were able to break the window in the original. Tommy says it's Halloween night in Haddonfield, where terror is supposed to be fun, when they hide behind masks and pretend they aren't who they are. He asks if he's real and who's next. Maybe not tonight or tomorrow, but the boogeyman is coming for him and them. He says he's not going to get to them because they won't succumb to fear. This whole speech is like one of the kind of speeches that like the host of a ghost hunting show is saying, trying to get you to believe that that sound of wind was a ghost. I thought it was just a super weird speech. They give a toast to Lori, and I'm assuming that when he says wherever you are, it's because normally Lori is with them. We cut to the end of 2018, where Lori, Karen, and Allison are in the back of the truck. We hear fire trucks go by, and Lori is screaming to let it burn. We finally get to see how Michael survived the fire. Did you guys know that there's a petition out wanting the beginning to be changed because he's killing firefighters? Some people just have way too much damn time on their hands. The firefighters come into the house and they start spraying water all through it. One of the firefighters falls through where Lori had shot at Michael from the basement up through the top of the floor. He asks for help, and we see Michael open up the door to where the guns are being stored. He's been hidden back there trying to avoid the fire. He attacks the first firefighter with a Halligan bar, and when one reaches down to help the guy that fell in, we see Michael come out. The firefighters realize that something is not okay, and start getting prepared for Michael to come towards them. They shoot him with a water hose, and in case you don't know, those water hoses will knock you on your ass and hurt or even kill you with how strong they are. Either Haddonfield has the worst water pressure known to man, or they tried to use this to show how strong he is, and it fell flat. We get a POV shot of someone getting hit in the face at the Halligan bar, and Michael starts attacking various other firefighters. We see one with a saw, and he goes to use it on Michael, but instead Michael overpowers him and turns it on the firefighter. Absolutely love how this scene is shot, with the fire being the light in the scene and everything else in shadow. Not to mention that scene where Michael walks out and the flames just engulf the porch is wicked. We cut to the hospital with Lori, Karen, and Allison. We jump around a lot through different POVs in this film, and that seems to be an issue with a lot of people from what I've been seeing online, and they tend to call it messy, but I think it adds to the chaotic nature of this movie, and it's not a messy quality. They're wheeling in Lori, and they keep asking her name, but she's semi-unconscious and is just not responding. Karen tells them that she's Lori Strode and was stabbed. Sheriff Brackett is now working security at the hospital, and he overhears that Lori's there. A nurse comes up to Allison, telling her that she should let someone look at her injuries. She tells him that she's fine, it's not her blood, and backs away almost in fear of being touched. Karen is washing her hands, and she cleans off her wedding ring and breaks down while Lori's in surgery. If we're going to do another movie with Lori in the hospital, at least she's awake for most of this movie. Karen and Allison sit together, and they finally mention that Ray is dead. How did they know that? Did they see his body? Did Lori tell them? Like, who knows? We cut to Sandra and Phil, who actually live close to Lori, and I love this couple. They're probably my favorite out of all the little mini couples that we meet throughout the movie. Phil says that the fire looks mostly out, and he says that Lori is a nutbag with a highly flammable lifestyle. Sandra tells him not to talk bad about Lori Strode because she will fuck him up, and I absolutely lost it. Phil wants to snack on some Cheez-Its and have a little sexy time with Sandra, but she is much more interested in flying her toy drone. She flies it into the bathroom, and Phil tries to show her how it's really done when it gets thrown from the bathroom into the recliner. Phil goes to check it out, and Sandra grabs a bottle just to be on the safe side. Phil goes in the bathroom, turns on the light, when Michael reaches up and just shatters it. Turns out he's bandaging his hands in the bathroom. Phil screams and goes to lock the door, telling Sandra to call the police because there's a big fella in the bathroom with a monster mask. She asks him, well, what the fuck does he want? And Phil goes, who gives a shit? Call the cops! And it is hilarious. I love them. As Phil's walking down the hallway, because this house is built really weird. Like, I don't know if it, like, is built in a U-shape or what. But, like, the bathroom, you can get to it from outside or something. I don't freaking know. But he's walking down the hallway, and it's all windows. And Michael, like, reaches through the glass, grabs Phil, is slamming his head against the wall. And, of course, Sandra's there just, like, screaming. She tries to take off through the front door. He ends up grabbing him and, like, slamming his head on a piece of glass that's sticking up. And so it causes the glass to, like, go through his neck, and then he just pulls him through the window. So he comes in the house. Sandra's at the front door. She grabs a knife, but, like, she kind of is just stuck there in fear. And it drove me insane. Like, as much as I love this couple, I'm just like, why are you not running? Like, open the fucking door and go. But she's just, like, frozen there. So Michael's coming at her. She's got these fluorescent bulbs, like, in the kitchen. He just palms one. And I don't know if you've ever, like, had one of those go out and you go to change it right after it goes out, but, like, you'll burn your damn hand off, it feels like. And he just, like, straight palms it, takes it down, and walks up to her. Like, I think he breaks it, like, cracks it in half, and then shoves it into her neck and twists it. And it is just so gross. And she, like, starts walking around, like, trying to get away, and she ends up falling to the ground. Phil's yelling for Sandra, so Michael grabs him, throws him on the counter, and we see that there's, like, this knife board on the wall, and he grabs various knives and just starts stabbing Phil over and over with each one, almost as if he's, like, testing them out. And at first, I didn't understand what was happening, but then we kind of pan around and you realize that Sandra has collapsed, cannot get up, is dying, and the last thing she sees as she is dying is her husband being stabbed to death. Like, it was just, crazy. We hear clapping as he finishes stabbing Phil, and he takes one of the knives with him, and we basically slot into the bar scene where someone's done with the talent show, and that's what the clapping was from. But it's like they're applauding Michael. It was super weird. So Marcus comes up to Tommy and tells him that he has no idea he was the kid from the Halloween story, and he ends up buying all of them a round of drinks. Lindsay apologizes for earlier when they were loud, and they're all just kind of hanging out and talking. They find out that the bar owner took over from his granddad, who had a bat named Old Hickory. Normally I would not mention this because this seemed absolutely pointless, but Tommy gets this bat in the end and carries, like, I don't know why he just didn't have a bat. Like, make him dress up in a costume as a baseball player and has a bat. Like, yes, it was nice to talk to the bar owner and have a little bit character, but, like, there's weird instances where we waste time with things like this instead of, like, furthering the story. So, Old Hickory will come into play later. While everyone's having a drink, Cameron calls Lonnie and tells him about Hawkins being attacked and that he needs help because he's over by the school. We get to see the aftermath of Lori's house, including another shot of the jack-o'-lantern cop head from Halloween 2018, which was wicked. Sheriff Barker is there, still with his cowboy hat on, and at first I was like, oh, it's a Halloween costume, but now I think it's a choice. So the police are now realizing that it's Michael Myers that's done all this. Everyone at the bar's phones start going off with, like, these little alerts, and we see a news report. We see that two people are missing, one is blurred, and of course the blurred one's Michael. The news report doesn't name him, so they aren't really sure, like, who these people are. We just know that there are two inmates from the bus crash that have escaped. Which, to me, is just a poor choice here, because, like, if they know enough to know exactly who's missing, they know their names, too. And wouldn't you think that the town of Haddonfield would want to know if Michael fucking Myers is missing? Like, come on. So they start talking about, you know, there's people that have died and this is reminiscent of a past incident in this town. So they start showing photos of past victims from the original Halloween. The clip they show of Bob is actually a real life photo of Bob Odenkirk. When they couldn't secure the likeness of the original actor, they used that photo because of how much he looks like the guy who played Bob. They see Julian on the news, and Marcus and Vanessa realize that he's that little smart-ass kid from across the street, and they are on their street with the news report. So now they've decided they're going to go home. And to me, if my neighbors have been attacked and there are dead people on my street, maybe I'm not going to go home right away. Maybe I'm just going to stay kind of close to the police station or something. Like, not in the line of fire. I don't know. But they decide that they're going to go. So as they're heading out, Marcus realizes he doesn't have his stethoscope and has to go back in. Vanessa goes to get in the car and she does not notice that it is covered in, like, fog on the inside of the car. Like, hello, Halloween 1, that's exactly how Annie died. So obviously there's someone in the car. She sees him in the back seat, jumps out screaming that it's Michael Myers in the car. She tells him to go look, and rightfully he says, hell no. So she runs into the bar for help. Tommy grabs the bat, says, love lives today, and puts money in the tip jar. Marcus says that the guy got out of the car, looked right at him. As Tommy walks up with the bat, the car's headlights come on. So obviously he didn't get out of the car. Like, I don't know what the hell that line is for, because he didn't get out. Unless he got out and went right back in. I don't understand. So music comes on, headlights are on, and Tommy is in this, like, soft voice, and he's like, I got this. But he doesn't sound like he's got this. So Figaro starts playing, and when that happens, I automatically am like, this isn't Michael. Besides the fact that we know he just killed Sandra and Phil, we don't really know how close the bar is to Lori's house, but, like, is it that close? So I figured it's the other patient. He switches stations and Tommy says, Michael, wake up, and hits the car with the bat. The car drives off, almost hits another car, and then crashes. Tommy looks in the car and it's empty minus a white umbrella. So obviously, this is Mr. Tivoli. Tommy says that he's gonna rip off his mask, look him in the eye, and swing Old Huckleberry. And then he says, night, night, twice. Tommy speaks a lot of one-liners, and he tends to repeat them. Like, at one point, he's saying, like, eyes up to someone else, and then he looks in the mirror and says it again as if he's saying it to himself. Like, spoilers, as much as I love Anthony Michael Hall, and I think he's a fantastic actor, he is my least favorite part of this movie. Like, it is frustrating. We cut to Big John and Little John, and when I read the script, I'll be honest, I'd hoped this entire scene was just updated, cut, whatever. In the script, they're realtors who bought the house. They're known to each other as Big Raj and Little Raj. And I just, it's frustrating because they've changed this scene for the worst. The introduction to Big John is absolutely hilarious. To see him like dancing around and trying to be all spooky, great. But the fact that they refer to each other as Big John, Little John, and these people are both about the same size, one's maybe a little heavier than the other, and one is a little smaller and taller, but like, there's not that much of a size difference to say, oh, the one who is taller but skinnier is Little John, and the one who's shorter but maybe a little heavier is Big John. Like, I feel like their size differences should be better. Or let's just not call them that, and especially let's not have them call each other that. I don't know of any couple that, like, besides calling each other, like, honey, baby, sweetie, goes through these weird nicknames like this, especially if they have the same damn name. Like, I just think this whole scene is so fucking annoying, and it has Danny McBride's fingerprints all over it. And also, Michael McDonald plays Little John. That's Stewart from Mad TV. So, immediate distraction, because I'm like, oh, great, Stewart. Like, it was frustrating. Can you tell I don't really like this scene? And it means a lot that Anthony Michael Hall portraying Tommy annoys me more than this scene. Well, there's two scenes with them because, you know, we can't just have one. And I know I'm in the minority. Most people tend to love them. And I think if it wasn't for some of the stupid choices that they make and their character names, I probably would have liked them more. Because it's nice to see gay representation in horror films. It's nice to see gay representation in films in general. But I just feel like this was more hokey and done for laughs and not portrayed seriously. And it's kind of frustrating. The kids ring the doorbell and they're saying that one of them got candy from this house and it had a razor blade in it. And so Little John goes outside and sees one of the kids is on the ground. Obviously, you did not give a kid candy with a razor blade in it, but he's all for it. Does not realize it's a joke or anything. You see there's fake blood, the kid's on the ground. He yells for Big John to call the police. Big John comes out and he's like, oh, the razor blade's in the vomit. All fake. Why do they believe any of this? God only knows. The front door slams shut and they're like, oh my God, is someone in our house? And then the next thing you know, it's a big prank. A kid comes out in a silver shamrock skull mask and the kid, like the one on the ground, screams and wakes up to scare them. And like I said earlier, all the kids in Haddonfield are assholes. Like, I don't know what is in the water in this town, but all of the kids fucking suck. So they tell them, like, oh, we pranked you. We stole the whole candy bag. Like, ha, 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 ha. So the Johns tell the kids about Michael Myers and that they live in his house. And, you know, if you come here uninvited, bad things will happen. And they talk about the ghost of Judith and how she still calls to Michael. And then Big John, like, gets in the kids, like, down on their level. And he's trying to explain to them, like, do you know what he did? He stabbed his sister. And he says the T word for boobies. And I don't like that word. Like, just say breasts. Or say boobies like I did, like a small child. But, like, don't say the T word. I don't know. I don't like it. It doesn't make sense because I swear like a sailor. Don't like it. But he says that, which, of course, made me laugh. Because I'm like, they're kids. They're asshole kids. But, like, don't say that to them. And it's just, this scene annoys me. Can you tell? I'm so irritated by this scene. So they scare the kids. They take off. We cut back to the hospital. We've got Karen with Lori, who's asleep. Allison is standing outside of the room when Hawkins arrives at the hospital. Allison is standing outside of what I guess is a makeshift morgue. Like, it is a room where you can see straight into it like a hospital, like nursery would be, with all these windows. And there's just dead bodies. Like, Sartain's naked ass dead body, dick out. We see it twice, like, right there. Oscar's dead body is right there. Like, what the fuck is going on in this hospital? I don't know if it's like all these dead bodies showed up, but at the time, those are probably the only dead bodies besides the podcasters and maybe even the mechanic if they found him yet. Which, how did they not find him yet? Like, we haven't got very far in the discovery because maybe they're getting the firefighters in at this point, but like, we don't see, maybe they're in the morgue and that's where these bodies came from. I don't know. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. They don't really explain it, but she's standing outside this morgue. Deputy Graham comes over and interviews Allison while Sheriff Barker interviews Karen. It was very interesting to see Allison saying, you know, I'm not allowed to talk about Michael. I'm not allowed to talk about what happened. And she says that Karen's biggest fear was that Lori was right and that Michael Myers was real and was after Lori. We see Karen's interview with Sheriff Barker, and she now believes everything that Lori told her. She believes that after 40 years, Michael was waiting for Lori and coming after her. And now she thinks that Lori has put her family in his path. She references Ray dying, which they never did, so they are really trying hard to make up for it in this movie. Allison admits that Sartain took Michael to Lori, which Karen is not aware of. Graham asks Allison how Michael knew, and Allison's like, he didn't know. Sartain knew. This was Sartain's obsession. And I watched a live stream with Cody Leach and a few others, and they talk about in the live stream how they wish that we would have seen the bus crash. And I've never really thought about it, but had we known from the beginning that Sartain was not a good guy, like he was not a Loomis replacement, I think it would have helped the reveal of Sartain not be as rough, not be as hated, if we had been clued into that. Because it's not something that you really wanted to be a twist. And apparently, he was saying in the live stream, one of the writers has come out saying that they tried to get the whole Sartain thing pulled, but he couldn't get it pulled, so I don't know. Karen says, you know, we shot Michael, we burned him to death. She's real proud of herself, but then Sheriff Barker confirms that Michael is still alive. And I guess at the same time, Graham is also confirming this to Allison, and she screams, "What?" But it is so weird and awful. Like, I know it's, like, had we had seen Deputy Graham telling Allison and she reacted like that, it probably would have been better. But, like, or if, like, Allison's coming back in the room and hears Barker tell Karen that, then that would reaction would make more sense. But, like, she's been sitting there calm, cool, and collected, and then all of a sudden just screams, "What?" and walks out of the room. Like, it, that was the first part in the movie where I was just like, because, like, I noticed it in theaters. I was like, I don't like that. And there's, the hospital stuff just gets weird. And it's kind of frustrating. But Cameron hears her screaming, and he comes running. And he tells her they're going to go after Michael. Karen starts freaking out, saying that Michael is headed here after Lori. She freaks out about police being here to protect them. Because, you know, as a little white lady, she's used to police being competent and protecting the white people and all this shit. She's not used to them not being good at their jobs. Because to her, they're always there on her side. They're always there to protect her. So I don't know. She's very much being a Karen towards wanting the police there to protect her mother. So Allison wants to go with Cameron. Karen's like, no, he's headed here. We have to protect Lori. Cameron's like, Michael has infected your family and he's infected my family with grief and fear for 40 years. We're going to kill him tonight. Allison should have taken this moment right here to explain to Karen that Michael is not after Lori, because maybe we wouldn't have that mob scene later, because she wouldn't be screaming that he's headed here to anyone that breathes in that hospital. But for whatever reason, she doesn't say anything, and she lets Karen think that Michael's after Lori, so he must be headed to the hospital. So Karen tells her, you know, we failed, he still survived, the police are gonna catch him. And she's like, do you think you're gonna be the one to catch him? I mean, she gets closer than anybody else, bitch. So, what can I say? She rightfully takes a shotgun to go see him, unlike this one bitch who brings an iron. So, maybe she could get him. Maybe she'd have more faith. So, she continues to flip the fuck out on the hospital. She's like, do you have security guards? You should have security guards. Don't you think security guards would be a good measure? And I'm just like, oh my god, I don't want to listen to this, because I deal enough with, like, seeing Karens in real life. I don't want to see it in a movie, especially because I like Judy Greer. Like, I don't want to see her being this bitch. So Allison ends up wrapping up the knife in Lori's shirt and puts it by her bed, and she kisses her on the forehead, and she's like, in case you need the knife, and then leaves and sneaks out of the hospital. Tommy and Lonnie are going over who all died and trying to figure out, you know, oh, first responders are dead, these people are dead, you know, whatever. Tommy's like, we have to work together. So Lonnie opens a tackle box full of guns, and Tommy's like, do you have a permit for all these? And Lonnie, of course, says some of them. And he's my favorite. He's so sweet. And I just want to be like, Tommy, Who the fuck cares if he has a permit? We're wanting to band all these people together to kill Michael fucking Myers. Who cares if he has a permit? Get the gun and let's shoot him. Don't get a fucking baseball bat. Get a gun. Shoot him in the head. Don't take a baseball bat and be like, ooh, I'm gonna hit him with this bat and I'm gonna beat him up. You're not cool, Tommy. You're not cool. So, I don't know. So, people from the bar show up, Allison, they're all here to help, and this is the beginning of the one-liners. Everybody starts saying them, it's super ridiculous. They start traveling all over town, telling everyone to either go home, or they recruit them to help. So Tommy's like, I need a few good people, I need good people, and it's like, take the bad people too, take anybody who's willing. Especially if the bad people don't feel as much remorse as maybe a good person, quote-unquote Tommy. Let the bad person go who wouldn't feel remorse about knocking the fuck out of Michael Myers and wouldn't hesitate versus taking a good person who's never killed anybody before and might hesitate and kill and get killed themselves. Like, use your brain, dude. So, they're in the car driving all over the place and Lonnie is drinking from a coffee cup. I can't figure out if he's drinking coffee to try to sober him up through all this or if he is drinking more. Truly, I don't care because it's hilarious either way. So, Marion's in the car and she's saying, you know, no one took Loomis seriously. He knew a killer when he saw one. My thing is, if we take away all of the other movies, so in Halloween 1 and 2, she works at Smith's Grove. And she works with Loomis. She's trying to take him back. In the second one specifically, she's trying to take him back to Smith's Grove to get him away from Michael Myers. In H2O, we find out later that she was the nurse that took care of Loomis until he died because he did end up moving to Haddonfield and I guess staying there. In this movie, we only have had Halloween 1 where we know of Marion. Did she live in Haddonfield and drive to Smith's Grove every day, or did she move here? Like, we don't know anything. We don't know if she took care of Loomis and he ended his days here because Michael wouldn't have even been here because the bus crashed here. So, like, that again, there's not a whole lot of explanation as to why Marion is here. And I truly had never thought of that until I watched this Cody Lee just live stream and they were talking about it. And I was like, holy shit, why the fuck is Marion in Haddonfield? Like, how do they know her? Like, they say, you know, these people are friends of Laurie Strode's, but, like, we know Marion from multitudes of movies, but, like, they're taking all those away. So, Marion moved here after being attacked here. Vicious Psycho lives here. She wants to live here, too. Like, I don't know. But whatever. I'm getting off track. So, Marcus is in the back seat with his wife, Vanessa. He's holding a gun. They're like, they handed me this gun. And she's like, well, have you ever shot it before? And he's like, no. So, she takes it from him and she's going to use it. Because I guess they didn't give her a gun, too. Which makes no sense. If you have enough guns for everyone, give everyone a gun. Marcus, Lindsay, Marion, and Vanessa pull up to a park and they see these kids swinging. These are the same kids that were fucking around with Big John and Little John. And these kids are so damn stupid. Because they're like, what are y'all doing out? And they're like, oh, it's Halloween. Are you going to kill us? Because she's like, you're in danger. You need to go. And, you know, not today, Satan. One of the kids says just to, like, say a funny line. But they're so fucking annoying, it's not funny. And I feel like, again, Danny McBride is just putting in humor. I don't really care for his humor. I've watched The Righteous Gemstones. I've seen a couple of episodes of Vice Principals. I'm not a fan of his humor. I've never been a big fan of it. And so it's frustrating because there are some funny parts, but I know a lot of it is his humor, which I don't like. So, very frustrating. One of the girls says that there is a guy in a white mask that keeps trying to play peekaboo. And they're like, we're not three. We think he's a pervert. And they're like joking and laughing. And they're like, oh, there he is. But then they realize that he's holding the mask, the Silver Shamrock's mask, of the guy that was with them. Now, I don't know if his head's in that mask. I couldn't quite tell because it's real bloody if his head's not in there. Michael ends up, because he's right by the car, because Lindsay has gotten out of the car. She was driving, left it running, and took off and ran over to these kids. Instead of driving the car to the kids and, like, going through the grass, who the fuck cares, we're chasing a killer. She's like, forever away. So Michael is by the car, and so he climbs on top of it. Marion sees him in the mirror, and you know, he throws the mask on the windshield. She shoots it; it goes flying, which again makes me think there might have been a head in it. But you know, if he's on the roof, shoot the roof. Like, don't shoot everything. But Marcus is yelling that they need to drive because, of course, rule for anyone. If you are driving with a group of people and the driver wants to get out and you are in a horror movie, tell the driver someone else needs to get out or get in the driver's seat just in case you'll need to make a getaway. Because this is how so many people in horror movies die. Because Marcus says they need to drive, but then he ends up not being able to because you got Marion trying to shoot the gun all over the place. She also locks the doors, I guess so he can't get in, but he is on the roof of the car. And I'm assuming Lindsay Child locks her, back doors to her car because Marcus and Vanessa now cannot get out of the car. But thankfully, Marion shoots out one of the windows. So Vanessa goes to climb out of the window and basically runs off when Michael busts through the window, just like in the first Halloween, grabs the back of Marion's head. He ends up pulling a whole wad of her hair out once Marcus gets his hands off of her. And so Vanessa's gone. God knows where she went. Lindsay's watching all this shit go down, putting bricks in one of the sacks that the kids were using for candy. I guess it's like a pillowcase. But no one's making a real swift, let's stop Michael Myers. They're all just running. So Michael jumps down. Marion yells for Michael. And she's like, this is for Dr. Loomis. Of course, the gun's empty. Because she has shot it at everything but Michael, so he climbs in the car and kills her and stabs her to death. Marcus tries to choke Michael with his stethoscope, but Michael ends up stabbing him through the fucking eye. And oh my god, this is so wicked. I shit freaks me out. I do not like it. So now Vanessa's gonna try to come up because her husband's dead and she's, two hands on the gun, shoot, misses every time. She gets close enough to the car, so she decides she's going to do it with one hand. And when she does it with one hand, Michael kicks the door open, the door hits the gun, and it turns backwards, and she shoots herself in the fucking face. My entire theater just lost their shit when this happened. It took a minute for them to calm down. And, even Michael does his famous head tilt as if to say, I cannot believe that worked. So then Lindsay comes running up. She hits Michael a few times with her bag of bricks and he goes to choke her. She tries ripping off his mask, but he ends up letting her go. So she takes off running. And when she does, she stops a couple of times to hide behind trees. And I'm like, she's a goner. There's no way she's going to survive this. But she ends up, there's a little bridge and she ends up going down because it's over a body of a little lake or whatever. And she goes down and hides in the root of the tree. I thought he was gonna cross the bridge and then stop and look at her, but he never does. And so she just hides there. This scene was very nerve-wracking because she's a goner. But she did that thing where she's trying to cover up her heavy breathing, which I appreciate because that is always such an annoying pet peeve of mine when someone is hiding in a horror movie and they're breathing as if they're asthmatic. So, I did enjoy this scene. I thought it was very, very well done. Lori wakes up. She's trying to sit up. Lori's like, I'm fine. And Karen's like, you just had a knife in your stomach. And Lori's like, it was a paper cut. Because, Lori's a badass. She asks where Allison is. And Karen's like, oh, fresh air. Because she sees a little note, I guess, with a heart on it. So, she knows she's gone. So Karen grabs Lori's shirt and she's like, oh my god, they just leave your bloody clothes everywhere. Here's the thing though, another thing that I noticed in the theater while watching this opening night, and it took me right out. That knife was wrapped in Lori's shirt and put beside her bed. So, is Karen just bitching to bitch because a nurse would have had to have come in and moved the shirt with the knife in it, or it was Karen who moved the shirt and knife while bitching about it being there. The exact thing she's complaining about, she would have had to have moved. I don't know. Drove me nuts. Took me right out. Lori says Michael's gone. Karen confirms it like an idiot. And then Hawkins is wheeled in. Lori's very upset to see him hurt. We cut over to Allison, who's in the car with Lonnie and Cameron, and she asks about knowing her dad. Because, you know, they're making up for ignoring his death in the last one. And Lonnie talks about doing peyote, because the one thing that we know about Ray besides peanut butter penis is that he smoked peyote with Lonnie. Now, Ray made it sound like it was Lonnie's drugs, but Lonnie makes it sound like it's Ray's drugs. And so he talks about how they go with a shaman, and they went and got high together, and Ray ends up getting freaked out by his own reflection, and so he took off all his clothes, and that was the last time Lonnie ever got high with him. And of course, Allison's, you know, laughing at this, but she's also, like, trying not to break down, because there's no more happy memories with her dad anymore, because he's gone. And it is a touching moment, but it just sucks, like, there was no acknowledgement for this poor man through the other movie. Like, it was like, oh, you died? Who cares? They drive up on Lindsay's car, Tommy arrives too, and they all get out and start looking for her. They find Vanessa and Marcus on the merry-go-round with the pumpkin and the skull silver shamrock mask on. You can see the tag on the pumpkin mask, and it is a silver shamrock mask, so those are now canon. They go out to the swings, and they see that Marion has the witch mask on and is all strung up in the swings. Which, of course, Lonnie is super like, oh my god, this is so fucked up. Like, he's really affected by these dead bodies. And Tommy's like, we'll get him. Allison ends up finding Lindsay on the ground, and she tells him that he's still out there. We cut back to the hospital, and Lori asks Frank if he's awake and asks if he remembers that night at the bar. We don't really know what night this was, but she talks about how messed up she was, and she tells him that he helped her out and that she always liked him. And then all of a sudden you just hear him say, you so crazy. And it's so funny. She's like, fuck you. It's really cute. And this is our brief history lesson. I love this scene because I'm a huge nerd. And last year they did a live Twitter watch with Blumhouse and Jamie Lee Curtis and a lot of the actors in the film and all that all watched it live on Twitter. You could tweet along with them. It was really freaking cool. It was one of my favorite things that came out of doing all this like weird stuck at home shit. And so I had tweeted out to Blumhouse asking if Frank was Lori's ex-husband, Hawkins. And I did not tag her in this, but Jamie Lee Curtis responded to me saying that they had history. And I could have died. So Hawkins says he remembers that night that he kissed her and she held his hand. He was hoping for more, but he knew that she was sweet on Ben Tramer. Now, Ben Tramer, if you've seen the other movies, is a name you recognize because he was in the original, someone they were trying to hook up Lori with, but he's also the one that's in the blonde Michael Myers mask that gets killed in the second one. But now that that's gone, maybe Ben Tramer was an ex-husband. So Lori tells him they got Michael. The relief for Hawkins is huge. He tells her it's about time. They laugh. They're in a ton of pain, though. Thankfully, a nurse comes in. Hawkins tells her he's an 11 on the 1 to 10 scale, and Lori asks the nurse to make his medicine a double. That is how you kill people, Lori, by giving them too much medicine. We cut to Lindsay talking about how they all would try to sneak into the Myers house, and Lonnie admits that he was too scared and he never went in. Then we cut to the hospital where Sheriff Brackett is telling Sheriff Barker that he was too busy telling his wife that their daughter was dead to put a bullet in Michael's head. He tells him now is not the time for prudence. A man asks how long it's going to take to find out if his brother's alive. He asks who's in charge, and we see how chaotic the hospital is getting. Deputy Graham says they're bringing in people from Russellville and Eaton County for backup because they can't handle the amount of people. Oscar's mom's there also looking for him. Tommy brings Lindsay to the ER and they wheel her away immediately, so of course she's done for the movie. But like, he just choked her a little and then she was fine, and not that much time passed from when she like hid in the grass to when she was found in the grass, so it's not like she's like has hyperthermia or something. So like, I don't know why they rushed her to the ER, why she couldn't help, and why she's gone for the rest of the movie. But I mean, I guess she survives. I would much rather see another character survive, but we'll get to that. So Tommy sees Karen, asks how Lori is, and Karen asks where Allison is, and he's like, oh, she's fine, she's Lonnie, no big deal. So Karen tells him that Michael is coming to the hospital, and of course Tommy's like, how do you know that? Well, then suddenly, they put the hospital on a lockdown. So Tommy's getting everyone's attention, saying the boogeyman is at large, and he has to come out, and he's an apex predator. And, like, when the hell did movies start using that term all of a sudden? Like, I've noticed it more and more in recent years that, like, in Crawl, he mentions that, you know, his daughter's like an apex predator, and like they say that a lot to describe things that are like vicious or fast or something. And I'm just like, why is this becoming vernacular? Like, I hate it. So Tommy is rallying people up at the hospital to look for Michael and is just screaming, but like, they're on a lockdown. They really kind of can't leave. But somehow they do, but who knows? So Sheriff Barker is literally watching Tommy spew his sermon instead of shutting this shit down. He is such an ineffective leader. Evil Dies Tonight is mentioned here and it becomes a chant later. And it's so annoying. Finally, Sheriff Barker is trying to calm people down, but it's too late. Sheriff Brackett's yelling Evil Dies Tonight, so everyone's cheering. Chaos fucking ensues. Had this had come out when it was supposed to, COVID not happened, what have you, I would have thought that this entire mob scene was too much and that it was over the top. But mob mentality is such a strong factor in our everyday lives here in the US. Like, it's either you're with us, you're against us. There is no, like, people just don't give a shit about each other here. Like, I don't know where it is where you guys may live, but like here, people don't give a shit about each other. Like, they could care less. And it's blatantly obvious. And mob mentality, I mean, we literally saw like neo-Nazis becoming a thing last year. And it was horrifying. And it was 2019 when that was happening, I think. I don't know. My years have bled together with this pandemic. But we're seeing these rallies and things like that. I mean, the insurrection, where that's a mob that just attacked. Like, it's more common now. And so I don't feel like the mob scene is over the top. I feel like it's stupid, and we'll get into that later. But I do think it is a valid thought process to have, and it is not over the top. So Tommy runs into Lori's room and he tells her that he killed Marion. Again, I don't know, you know, unless there's some secret backstory we're not aware of, why the fuck Lori would care or even know who Marion is. So he tells her, you know, 40 years ago, you protected me, and now I'm going to protect you. And so Lori kicks the nurse out, and she sends Tommy off to go find Michael. Karen's telling Lori they need to let the police do their job because there's a system. And Lori's like, the system failed, which rightfully so. Like, he decimates everyone he comes into contact with. So Lori gets out of bed, grabs the medicine and the syringe, stabs it in her wound. She's ready to fucking go. And she tells Karen that he could take her head as she takes his, and that maybe the only way he dies is if she dies too. She tells her, you know, y'all should not have to keep running from this darkness that I created, and I have to let her go. Lori finds the knife that Allison left for her, and Karen tells her she's not going to let anything happen to her. There's a lot of grandstanding, a lot of Shakespearean dialogue kind of things happening here. The dialogue is a lot in this movie. So we cut back to Big John and Little John, because why the fuck not? We're already annoyed. Let's get more annoyed. And they're talking about bees, and they're watching this movie, and we hear knocking on the back door, so they think the kids are back. Little John goes to the door, yells for them to knock it off, and we then hear someone at the front door. So Big John decides to scare them with a golf club, and Big John asks if he locked the back door. And when Little John goes back there, he sees that there is now blood on the wall, and the door is open. So he tells him there's someone in the house that's not a child. For whatever fucking reason, Big John drops the golf club, takes off his jewelry, his robe, and then picks up a charcuterie cheese knife, saying, I got this knife. For those of you that don't know, it is meant to cut cheese, and it is maybe as long as your pinky finger. And sometimes it's rounded because it's a blunt object used to spread the cheese, not necessarily like do a whole lot of knifing. So then Little John grabs a bigger knife and he's like, well, I got this knife, because they're like mimicking each other. And so we hear him walking around upstairs. Big John locks the front door, so now they are trapped inside with whatever is in their house, because, you know, that's smart. We go back to the hospital. Everyone's standing around screaming at each other. The other escaped patient, Mr. Tavoli, is now walking around, and people are like, I saw him on TV. That's him. That's him. He's asking for help, like screaming for help, bleeding, and everyone's like trying to place who he is. Lori asks Tommy what's going on, and he asks if it's Michael. And I guess someone misheard him, because at that moment you hear people saying it is Michael. Yeah, totally Michael, even though he's about a foot shorter and is in patient gear. But I guess they have not realized that Michael has performed a costume change. So they chase after him. Lori tells Tommy to get him. He takes off, but not before yelling while pointing his finger in the air like an old man, "Evil dies tonight," while everyone else starts yelling and chanting after Mr. Tivoli. Big John and Little John decide they're going to check the house, and they go room to room saying Big John and then Little John, and they call back and forth to each other, I guess to say clear, clear, but instead we're more annoying. So Little John gets scared by his own reflection. Big John goes into what was Judith's room, and Michael comes up behind him and stabs him in the fucking armpit, and then proceeds to grab him by the face and gouge out his eyeballs in this ridiculously gross eyeball scene. Like, it was awful. Little John runs upstairs, finds Big John's body. He sees Michael staring out the window, and he says his name, causing him to turn around and look at him. And he's like, "You've come home." And he just stands there. He doesn't run. He doesn't scream. He just stands there. And we cut to an outside shot with a viewpoint through the window, and we hear Little John scream as Michael goes after him and kills him. We cut back to the hospital, and Lori and Karen realize it's not Michael. They start shouting to everyone, it's not him. Lori's screaming at everyone, calling them sheep. A doctor ends up grabbing Lori, but she knees him and, like, kicks his ass, ripping open her stitches, and she falls to the ground, bleeding everywhere. Deputy Graham helps Karen get Lori back to her room while Karen's trying to tell him that it's not Michael. Poor Oscar's mom just walks up and sees his dead body in that makeshift morgue. Karen's running around trying to get everyone to stop, saying that that's not Michael. You know, you don't know what he looks like, that's not him. Everyone is now shouting in the stairwell trying to get up to the next floor because he's, you know, taking off through the stairwells. They're fighting each other. Barker stares straight into the camera and just screams as a woman yells that they're going to kill him, meaning Mr. Tivoli. So Lori's talking to Hawkins and she's saying that Michael's masterpiece is happening. It's all her fault. And Hawkins says he could have made it go away. He tells her it's not her fault, it's his. We flash back to 1978 where he tells her what happened. They unmask Michael, they knock him to the ground, and he could not let Loomis go to kill him because right then and there, Loomis is going to shoot him in the head and kill him. But Hawkins grabs his arm and lifts it, saying, you know, I kept thinking that's someone's baby boy and I couldn't let him do it. He says it's all his fault and he now knows that Michael is pure evil. Lori tells him that it's just Michael, what Michael has done to this town, to these people. She tells Frank, you know, you're a good man, but we have to kill him. Lori says she's the one that needs to kill him. And I like that they include this scene because it shows that it's not just Lori who's tormented by Michael. We see many different views of PTSD for the people of Haddonfield. I've seen a lot of reviews where they're like, oh, this doesn't move the plot. This is boring. I don't care about these other people. What is the point of talking about all this trauma? And it expands more about the people at Haddonfield. The first movie is about PTSD and overcoming your trauma. This movie is about survivor's guilt and how this town is trying to move on from what happened 40 years ago. And of course, when it starts up again, the lengths that these town people will go through so no one has to go through what they've been through because they've survived when their friends didn't. So Karen catches up to Mr. Tivoli and tells him that she knows that it's not him. She locks him in between these glass doors so she can stop everyone, but they won't listen and they're grabbing chairs and anything they can trying to break through the glass. Mr. Tivoli ends up grabbing an extinguisher and breaks the window. As they break through the doors, he jumps to his death. Mr. Tivoli was actually played by Ross Bacon, who passed away on March 16th of this year from lung cancer. The crowd in the hospital keeps chanting "Evil dies tonight," and for some reason think that Michael would jump to his death. The crowd below realizes that he's not who they thought, and the carnage on the ground is rough. And you even have, like, this twitch from the body that is just... it's very, like, you get cold chills. And then knowing that Mr. Bacon actually passed away this year, like, I can only imagine how hard that was for his family to watch this scene. I wasn't even aware that he passed away until being on Reddit and saw and, like, looked up his obituary to be like, oh my gosh, he did pass away. Like, I hope he got to see his film. But, like, that had to be rough for the family to see. So... Brackett tells Tommy that it's not Michael, and he says that Michael always wore a mask. How would we know what he looks like? Again, There would have probably been a mugshot, a trial, something like that. Like, how the hell did they not figure that out? Brackett says that he is turning them all into monsters, and we pan around to different residents in Haddonfield, and they're all just kind of like, oh my god, we're the monster, whatever. So we go back to 1978 and see that they decided that Pete was going for Michael with his gun, and then it went off as if Pete accidentally shot himself. So they trade out the guns, and Hawkins' secret is kept. Lori and Karen are arguing, and Lori says he's after her. Hawkins tells Lori that Sartain brought Michael to her. Hawkins tells her that this is not about her. And it is that moment of like, holy shit, she's going to realize that it's not about her. That she's been tormented and has basically ruined her life for someone who does not even realize that she's the same person, much less that she exists. He just sees her as a person he wants to kill. It's nothing special like, oh, she's Lori Strode. It is, ooh, you're in my way. Death. He says that Michael is a six-year-old boy with the strength of the man. He says that Michael is a six-year-old boy with the strength of the man and the mind of an animal. He says that when he was a kid, he would stand at the window in Judith's room and just stare. He mentions that Pete died after standing on that exact same spot, and he says that before his death, he had to have known. Maybe Michael isn't looking out as much as he's looking in at his reflection in the window. We then cut to a shot of Karen looking at her reflection. Hawkins says they don't know why he's killing, but it always seems to him that Michael wants one thing. And we immediately cut to Lonnie saying that he's going home. He shows Karen and Allison a map that says, you know, from Lori's house to this house to this house to this house, it's a straight shot to his childhood home on Lampkin Lane. Allison says that's where we're headed next. So Karen and Tommy are talking. Tommy apologizes. She tells her that he took her daughter to go chase a killer and an innocent man is dead. She's like, none of us are innocent. He tells her that he fucked up and he's sorry. She's like, are you going to stand here just hating yourself? He says he has to keep trying, but if he goes down, then he's going to go down swinging. Karen says she needs a car. Tommy says he has a car. So they're going to go off on their own. So Lonnie arrives at the Myers house and he tells him he's going to go in alone. He calls himself a fucking dummy for bringing his kid to the belly of the beast. Allison asks if he expects her to stay while he confronts the man who killed her father. He said that he is asking for her and Cameron's sake to stay and honk if they see anything suspicious. Lonnie tells Cameron that he'll see him at the finish line and goes in. After a few moments, they hear a gunshot go off and run in. Of course, they open a closet, shoot first, ask questions later. I legit thought that they were going to kill Lonnie right here, but it turns out it was just a pumpkin. We see Michael has ended up posing the Johns and a photo, or like a photo that they have hung up. And it was nice to see him doing a little bit of the posing, because like some people were like, oh my god, why is he posing them? Like, that's so fucking weird. And it's like, he posed Annie to look like his sister, like above her headstone. He basically stuck Bob to the wall with a knife. He puts Linda in that cabinet so when Lori opens it, she sees her sitting there. Like, he does this. With the cops, he posed them, the babysitter. He posed her under the sheet. Like, this is going back to that, like, kind of childlike Michael Myers. So this is not unusual to see him posing people. So for whatever reason, Allison takes the knife that is stabbed into Little John as Cameron goes through the hallway. Blood drops on his hand and he looks up and sees that Lonnie is stuffed into the attic, dead. My question is, how did he get him up there so fast? But what do I know? So Michael comes rushing out of the closet and stabs Cameron. Allison tries to shoot him, but he knocks the gun out of the way. She grabs the knife and stabs him a few times in the gut. He looks at her like he grabs her head and he looks at her for a minute and then he slams her face against the banister and then throws her down the stairs. When she hits the bottom, she breaks her leg. Cameron takes the knife out of his stomach and tries to get the gun to shoot Michael but he ends up stomping his wrist. Michael picks Cameron up and slams his head through the banister and then back and forth from top to bottom. Allison's yelling no and she's screaming for Michael to come get her. He ends up slamming Cameron to the ground and comes down the stairs, but not before stopping and twisting Cameron's neck, killing him. Michael is going to torture everyone if he has an audience and the time. Michael makes it to Allison, who's hobbling back trying to stab him. He turns the knife on her, trying to stab her, and she's yelling, "Do it, do it." She looks behind him screaming, "Do it," when Karen comes up and stabs Michael in the back with a pitchfork. He falls down onto the stairs and she stomps on his face. Both just one time. Like, what are you doing? Keep killing him. She then rips his mask off, goes outside, and with him, he gets up unmasked and is following her. She's yelling for him to kill her. She tells him, you know, I'm an innocent woman, just like your sister. It's Halloween in the same house. Like, it's really awkward how she says it, but whatever. So he ends up following her, and Karen runs off in between houses a few blocks away. This, like, stoic walk of Michael's as an old man without the mask on is super creepy, but, like, at the same time, I wish we wouldn't have seen as much of old man Michael. Like, let's keep him in the shadows. So Michael sees his mask on the ground, and Karen says, gotcha, as the lights come on around Michael. Haddonfield is ready to take care of Michael. Brackett says everyone is entitled to one good scare, and Michael picks up the mask and puts it on. Here's the thing. Most of these people have sticks, like hockey sticks, bats. One lady has a fucking clothes iron to beat Michael with. Lonnie, Cameron, and Allison were the smartest people in this town bringing guns. One person brings a gun, but they don't ever go for a headshot. So they all start hitting Michael, but they're all going one at a time, like, you hit him, you hit him, you hit him, I'll hit him. Like, it's super fucking weird. The person with the gun tries to shoot Michael, but he slices their hand really bad and they end up missing. They then try again, they shoot him 5 times. Again, all in the chest, nothing in the face. I get it's because we have another movie coming, but like, don't write these people to be stupid just for your other movie. Like, don't have anybody bring a gun, because then it just makes them stupid. So he falls to the ground and they all start beating him, again, one at a time. And then they just kind of stop and wait. Karen walks up, Tommy's like, we got this, go be with Allison. She sees Michael reaching for his knife, and she picks it up, she stabs him in the back. Like, stab him in the face. Whatever. We get a voiceover from Lori saying that she thought that Michael was flesh and blood, but a normal man cannot survive what he's been through. We hear the thing from the Lena trailer, the more he kills, the more he transcends to something they can't kill. Fear is the curse of Michael. And then we see that Allison is being held by Karen. She says he'll always be here even when we can't see him. She's referencing what Karen said about Ray at the hospital, but in this moment it feels more like she's talking about Michael. Lori says you can't defeat him with brute force. Hawkins says if they only knew then what they know now. Brackett walks up to Michael, but Michael quickly grabs the knife out of his back and slices Brackett's throat. The gun is out of bullets, so Michael stabs that person too. And again, they're all attacking him one at a time. We see him kill these people one by one with like this blacked out background, so you really can't see anybody else. And like, I saw a lot of people being like, oh, it was COVID, they couldn't film up close, that's why this scene's so weird. No, this was pre-COVID. They like just filmed it like this for no fucking reason. He's slicing everyone's throats, we see blood is splattering everywhere, we get a good shot of like blood all over the mask. It's really cool for a sec. Tommy's just kind of frozen watching all of this happen. We get a voiceover from Lori saying that it's the essence of evil and the anchor that divides them and the terror that grows stronger when they try to hide. Karen looks up in the window of the Myers house and she ends up seeing a flash of Michael as a child in the clown costume. Then we get Michael and Tommy and they're kind of facing off. Tommy goes to swing the bat and just as he does, Michael stabs him. They are face to face with Michael looking down at Tommy. Tommy falls to his knees and then falls completely to the ground. Lori says if they don't stop him tonight, maybe they'll find him tomorrow or next Halloween when the sun sets and someone's alone. We see Tommy screaming and we get a quick cheesy shot of Michael like squaring up with the bat like he's prepping for his T-ball photo. And then he hits Tommy with it and you just see blood fly up everywhere. So I'm assuming it's like a head-crushing shot, and we'll get a nice, juicy view of that in the next movie. So Karen goes upstairs to the window. She sees Cameron and Lonnie's dead bodies. She goes into Judith's room. Lori says, you can't close your eyes and pretend he isn't there, because he is. Karen goes to the window and looks out. She closes her eyes and takes a deep breath, and then Michael shows up behind her, stabbing and slashing at her over and over again. She falls to the floor. We flash between Lori, Karen's dead body, and Michael. Michael stares at his reflection and we hear him take a breath. Credits roll and the theme starts. And that's the movie. For those of you wondering how Michael made it back to his house, either this is a dream sequence, which would be dumb, or Michael maybe just walked through like the 2 to 3 yards that Karen ran through and snuck in through the back. Michael sneaks up on people all the time. So I don't understand the confusion here. Like, I know this movie has its many detractors, but I'm sorry. You cannot call this movie the worst movie of the year when Malignant is right there. Like, get the fuck out of here with that nonsense. Malignant is terrible. I actually really liked Halloween Kills. As much as I've been bitching about it, I did really like this movie. I thought it was a lot better than people were giving it credit for. It's the second film of a trilogy. It's not going to bring a lot of new stuff to the table, but I will say the dialogue here is a legit problem. There's a lot of one-liners, a lot of Shakespearean moments in this film, but honestly, the dialogue wasn't great in the original either. So, like, it's not like these movies are known for great dialogue and then it just drops off. I get that's kind of a cheap way to look at it, to be like, oh, well, you're not terrible, so here's your passing grade for not being, you know, better. But at the same time, I don't go to slashers for their dialogue. Does that give an excuse for some really shitty dialogue in slashers? Sure. But at the same time, I'm not going to knock this movie for its dialogue. I'm here for Michael Myers just causing chaos, knocking people down left and right, and that's what I got. So, to me, not terrible. Not this, like, worst movie I've ever seen. Oh my god, this is worse than Resurrection. Like, anyone that's saying that shit is saying it because it's cool to hate on shit. So, I don't know. It's frustrating. The original is a fantastic movie that catapulted an entire genre, but I think people look at it through rose-colored glasses because they're like, oh, it's Halloween. It's not, like, there are stupid moments in that one, too. Like, Laurie, multiple times, will go to, like, stab Michael with a knitting needle and then just sit there and turn her back on him. She'll think he's dead after one hit and just sit there. Like, it happens. Something's in the water at Haddonfield, because this is what they all apparently do. And again, second movie in a trilogy. You can't kill him off. Is it frustrating? Absolutely. But they could have easily just not brought any guns. Like, everybody just brought, like, stuff to beat the shit out of him with. It would be stupid, but it would be a lot less stupid than the person who brings a gun and doesn't shoot for his fucking head. I would much rather be saying, why didn't anyone bring a gun, than why didn't they shoot him in the head? Like, I feel like that's common knowledge. And I think because of the delay and all that, like, truly with the whole delay situation, I think if they had any inkling that they were going to do streaming, they should have just released it last year. Because I think waiting a year just amped people up, and I think that's where a lot of the problems are, is that you had this movie that everyone was anticipating, and then it has to be held off for a year, and then it's held off for a year, and immediately we're told it's going to streaming too. So of course everyone's like, why is it going to streaming? That cannot be a good sign. And so you've already got people that are thinking bad thoughts about the movie. So I get how it happened. And you also have people that are going into this looking for perfection. Perfect movies do not exist, people. You know why? Everybody's different. You cannot make a perfect movie because that would mean that everybody likes the same shit, and they don't. This movie is super brutal, it's violent, it's called Halloween Kills, so I don't know how that wasn't expected. This movie, though, does feature a different ending. In the original script, Karen was going to call Laurie from the bedroom, Michael would kill Karen and then pick up the phone, Laurie would hear his breathing and then tell Michael she's coming for him. And the really cool thing that I had seen was that this movie is actually bookend by similar shots. So Halloween 2018 ends with a zoom in on the knife from that Allison is holding in the truck. Well, then Halloween Kills would start with the knife again. And then the movie would end with Laurie leaving the hospital with the knife. But of course, because they're doing a time jump for Halloween Ends, they had to cancel that. Which, here's my thing. Setting three movies within a 24-hour period of Halloween is really stupid. Because at this point, it has to be like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. It is November 1st, people. Like, it's not Halloween anymore. Do I think a 4-year time jump is smart? Probably not. But I am curious what they're going to do with it. Because they're talking about the political climate and things like that that they're going to introduce. Which a lot of people are like, oh, COVID. Michael's going to die by COVID. Ha 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 ha. No, I think it's going to be the divide in the United States is going to be a strong part of this movie. I think a lot of where everyone's like, oh, police, police, I think how they aren't going to trust the police is going to be a big thing because the police did not help the people in Haddonfield. You notice it was Haddonfield doing it themselves. So I think that will be a big factor. I think it's going to be more political than COVID. I don't necessarily know they're going to include COVID. My other thing is, like, David Gordon Green has been saying some weird shit anyways. Like, they ask him if he thinks that Michael is supernatural, and he said no. Which, I'm sorry. Your whole mob scene, like, when they all attack him at the end, no person would survive that. They shot him 5 times. And he gets up and fucks them all up. Like, dude, supernatural. You keep hinting at it this whole movie. Why are you saying stupid shit? There's no way that you can make him seem supernatural with his whole, like, he transcends as he kills bullshit, and then just make him human and kill him by human means. Like, you're gonna piss off everybody. Good job. So, I don't know. I think it's... There's some odd things that are being said, and I don't know if it's to, like, trip everybody up, to, like, hype them up, or piss them off, or I don't know. It's just there's some weird stuff being said. I have no idea. The other thing to think of with the time jump is that there's a lot of people that are down for the count. You've got Lori, who's recovering in the hospital from surgery. Hawkins is in the hospital recovering. Allison has a broken leg. Like, our main people are down for the count. They can't just get all upright and just start going after Michael fucking Myers, who's already killed half the town. Like, they need to be ready. Now, how they're gonna pull off this time jump, I don't know. Maybe it'll be like Halloween 4 and he'll get nursed by this old man in a shack. I have no idea. I am very curious, though, to see how it ends. To me, the first movie is all about Lori. The second movie is more focused on Karen. So I feel like Halloween Ends has to primarily feature Allison. They've made it all about the Strode women. So I feel like Allison is the last one standing. Plus, are they going to kill Michael? Probably going to kill Lori. There's a lot of people that didn't want to see another Lori story. So would you rather see Michael in various other stories after Ends? Although be careful, because that's how we ended up with Halloween Resurrection. Now for our closing segment in Terror Tea, the high tea and the low tea. In Terror Tea, the high tea moment is the part of the film that's action-packed, adds a bit of scare to the movie, where the low tea is the lesser part of the film, or even my least favorite part. For Halloween Kills, it's no surprise, my low tea moment has to be Tommy Doyle. I did not like his character, I hated his dialogue the most. Getting rid of him, or making him a lesser character, putting him in like cameo spot with Marion, would have improved this movie greatly. Close second is going to be the mob scene. I get having it, don't get me wrong. I understand having it. My problem is the fact that they did not cast an actor of the same build. The man who plays Mr. Tivoli is like a foot and a half shorter, is a stockier guy, looks absolutely nothing like Michael Myers. So it makes no sense to have two different people play these. Like, if you're wanting them to accidentally think it's Michael, cast someone that looks like him. That would make so much more sense. I would appreciate the mob scene so much more if it was just a person who fucking looked like Michael Myers. But of course, I'm just a fan. What the hell do I know? The high tea moment has to be the flashback to 1978. The mask looks incredible. The set decorations, the costumes, the hair, everything felt like you were walking in 1978. The practical effects to dress up an actor to look like Loomis, all of it. Just the score, it felt like you were in 1978 watching the original Halloween, which is someone who was not even born then, that feeling was incredible. Because that's something like a lot of my childhood favorite horror movies, I was too young to see in theaters. So getting as an adult to see them on the big screen has always been cool, but getting to see this, where this is the something that I'm seeing in theaters, I'm growing up with, and they're taking me back and it feels legit, like, it was just absolutely awesome. I cannot wait to see behind the scenes featurettes. Like, I'm such a nerd, like, I just kept thinking, I can't wait to see the behind the scenes for all this. I can't wait to see the featurettes. Like, I don't know what's wrong with me. What did you guys think? Did you love Halloween Kills? Hate it? Let me know all your thoughts. You can find me all over social media. I'm on Twitter @terror_t, over on Instagram @terror.t. We're also on Facebook in the Terror T group. You can catch horror news, among other things, over there. Come join us. If you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to the podcast. And if you really like it, leave me a 5-star review. Again, I'm your host, Tara, and this has been Terror T.